Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You are listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Olubunmi Bakari. This is our All Things Local series, where we highlight the local history, culture, communities, and personages who have made an impact on Washington, D.C. My guest today is Dr. Samir Magelli. Dr. Magelli is an historian, writer, educator, and serves as the chief curator at Smithsonian's Anacostia Community Museum in Washington, D.C. Dr. Magelli is also the co-author of The Global Cipher, Hip Hop Culture and Consciousness, co-editor of New Perspectives on the History of Marcus Garvey, the UNIA, and the African Diaspora, and his writings have appeared in the New York Times, Black Arts Quarterly, the Western Journal of Black Studies, among other places. He is currently at work on a book entitled Between New York and Paris, A Transatlantic History of Hip Hop. Dr. Magelli joins me today to discuss Anacostia Museum's newest exhibit, A Right to the City, which highlights six Washington neighborhoods and the unsung heroes who have shaped them. Dr. Magelli, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So should I call you Samir or?
Whatever you'd like.
Samir is shorter.
That works.
Okay. So I have to start off this interview appropriately. When did you first fall in love with hip hop?
Well, you know, I'm in many ways, I'm an 80s baby. I was born and raised in the 80s and in a place called New Haven in Connecticut, just an hour north of New York City. And so hip hop was very much a part of just the everyday culture in the city where I grew up. B-boying, B-girling, breaking, DJing, graffiti, and so it was just there. You know, mm-hmm. It was a part of everyday life. You saw it day in and day out, and you know, it was just the music that was the soundtrack to my life mm-hmm. in that period. And so there wasn't one moment when I fell in love with hip hop. It kind of just grew over time.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you who don't get it, that's from Brown Sugar. That was a question that the heck was her name? Sanaa Lathan's character would ask all the hip hop heads that she would interview for XXL magazine. That was the first question she would ask them. Okay. So basically, you kind of, would you define hip hop as like the breaking and the b-boy and the DJing?
Yeah, I mean, hip hop is really a multidimensional culture. You have the breaking, also known as breakdancing, which is the dance element. You have rapping or emceeing. You have DJing, and you have graffiti. So people tend to think of hip hop as having those elements, but you know, it's much more than that. There's the language, the way of speaking, the way of dressing, way of moving in the world, and so all of that kind of makes up hip hop.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about hip hop today?
Well, you know, I feel about hip hop today the way I've always felt about hip hop. It's just, it's a rich culture with so many dimensions to it. Mm-hmm. And you can still see in all parts of the world, the culture is thriving, not just the music, but also these other elements, the dance and the graffiti, the visual art dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a thriving culture, and it's bigger and more global than ever. And, you know, you can kind of find whatever you're looking for in it in terms of styles and genres, subgenres. And so hip hop is definitely thriving.
Mm. And so you mentioned you grew up in New Haven. So, and hip hop was definitely a part of your life. So how did that shape you? And is there anything from your childhood that kind of shaped where you're at right now as far as your career? And
yeah, absolutely. So this new exhibition, A Right to the City, that we just opened at the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum, deals with an issue that is very much an urgent issue in Washington, D.C., you know, neighborhood change and gentrification, but was also very much an issue that shaped the city that I grew up in, New Haven. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the main kind of historical themes that we address in the exhibition is the federal policy of urban renewal, which came about in the 1950s and 1960s. And the city that I grew up in, New Haven, received more urban renewal dollars per capita than any other city in the country. Mm-hmm. And so New Haven was transformed by urban renewal and similar processes that have transformed and now are continuing to transform Washington, D.C. So they were not issues that were new to me when I began this work 3 years ago for the museum of researching the history of neighborhood change. And so those are issues that I was very familiar with personally, having grown up in a city that was changed and shaped by them. But, you know, D.C. has such a unique history of its own that, you know, I was able to draw on that interest and personal experience and understanding how and why neighborhoods and cities change and are transformed, but really trying to uncover the rich history that's unique to the district and work with communities to document and share that history.
So you mentioned New Haven received more federal money. Why was that?
Well, New Haven, like a lot of other cities in the 1950s and 60s, were struggling economically and often were racially segregated. And the then mayor of New Haven was adamant about receiving federal dollars through this new policy of urban renewal to redevelop the city. Mm-hmm. And so he was a big advocate for receiving the dollars that were granted to municipalities to carry out redevelopment. And so New Haven ended up receiving large amounts of federal dollars to carry out urban renewal and ended up transforming the city through the construction of freeways, the demolition, large-scale demolition of portions of entire neighborhoods. And so that, much like D.C., transformed the city.
Mm-hmm. So before we go into discussing the exhibit, I want to talk a little bit more about your background. I know you come from academia. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So I got my PhD in history from Columbia University, New York City. And, you know, what had me wanting to get my PhD in the first place was a lot of the community history, public history projects that I had an opportunity to do while I was an undergrad in Philadelphia and then in New York City. And, you know, I kind of pursued the traditional path of an academic after finishing my PhD of becoming a professor. And I did that at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for several years. Mm-hmm. And taught and did research there. And then when this opportunity opened up at the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum, mm-hmm. you know, the museum has a particularly unique history of doing both rigorous and serious scholarly research, but also doing it in a deeply community engaged and community collaborative way. And so it was an opportunity, I thought, to really marry both the serious scholarly research with the work that I loved doing, which was community-based mm-hmm. work. And that kind of a background is what prepared me really to be able to do the work that I've been doing since I came to the museum 3 years ago.
Yeah, and that was my actual follow-up question. So you say that the experience in teaching helped prepare you for becoming a curator.
Yeah, I mean, so I would say that doing the research and particularly doing community-based research, which is something that I've done now for you know, more than 10, 15 years, along with teaching and being in the classroom mm-hmm. and working with young people, were all important parts of the preparation for being a curator. And I had done some curatorial work before, both in New York and in Philadelphia with different institutions, and had done a lot of community-based public history projects, community history projects that are very similar to the work that the Anacostia Museum has done. So mm-hmm. it all, yeah, definitely helped prepare me for that work.
So when did you know you wanted to, like, study history or go into history as a career field?
Well, you know, there was one project in particular that I worked on, which was my first public history, community history project. And it was while I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, and I had had an interest in hip-hop music and history, having been a DJ myself, but also had an interest in African-American history and the history of the African diaspora, and had been doing research in Brooklyn, New York, interviewing a lot of hip-hop artists of a particular generation who often made reference to Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. I mean, there were artists like Mos Def and Talib Kweli, mm-hmm. but also AZ. There were artists like X-Clan, mm-hmm. Who very much came out of that tradition, mm-hmm. and would name check the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Marcus Garvey, in their lyrics. And but I also happened to be able to work with an organization called the Marcus Garvey Memorial Foundation, whose work is all about raising awareness about the history of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and the work of Marcus Garvey. And so we were able to, in this project that developed, really bring together several generations of people who had either worked with Garvey and the UNIA in Brooklyn and New York City more broadly, as well as jazz musicians of the jazz generation, like Randy Weston and Max Roach before he passed, along with hip-hop artists, to try to really have an intergenerational conversation about the history and legacy of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, which many people knew and identified with Harlem because that was one of the first chapters. But Brooklyn had its own rich history of Garveyism and activism. And so we were able to bring those folks together. And for me, as a young person at the time, 19 years old, to be able to see those connections across generations and being able to have the opportunity to bring people together who had much in common, but who were rarely actually at the table having conversations with one another, was a powerful thing. So to be able to see the power of history to connect people and make those connections across generations was part of what really inspired me to want to study history, seeing how history could actually play out mm-hmm. and empower people in people's everyday lives.
So how do you, connect to the past?
Well, the more you know about the past, the more you realize it's everywhere around us. It shapes the world and has shaped the world in ways that I think we tend not to think of. Mm-hmm. Here we are sitting in the neighborhood of Adams Morgan. When you start to understand where the name itself of the neighborhood, Adams Morgan, came from, mm-hmm. which I'm sure we can talk about later, mm-hmm. It begins to open your eyes to the history of this place, an understanding of its evolution and its development, to better understand, the dynamics of neighborhood change. And so history, really applies to any part, any aspect of our daily lives. Once you begin to peel back the layers, there's history there. Mm-hmm. And, I think ultimately knowing more about the past empowers us to better understand where we are today and hopefully also shape our thinking about the future. So history, even though it is, and I myself thought as a young person that history tended to be a dry and boring kind mm-hmm. of subject, but the more you begin to see its power to shape your understanding of the world and your place in it, the more you can appreciate its relevance.
So would you say that you study history to learn about the past or learn from the past?
Both. Mm-hmm. I think as a historian, my mission is really to achieve a better understanding of what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the questions we ask about the past are very much shaped by the present. And so, even as we're studying to better understand, better document the past, we're doing so with questions that are coming from the vantage point of today. And so in that sense, both learning about the past and learning from the past.
Mm, interesting. So now let's switch gears and go into this new exhibit, A Right to the City, which focuses on six neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. And the D.C. was sort of, would you say, the launching ground for urban renewal? Can you speak a little bit about that?
The federal policy of urban renewal really in many ways took off in Washington, D.C. It was mm-hmm. not necessarily the first place where you had urban renewal projects, but it was one of the first mm-hmm. And certainly one of the largest, earliest projects. And, the federal policy of urban renewal was really about the federal government you know, providing funds to municipalities to redevelop neighborhoods that were deemed blighted. And in Washington, D.C., sitting between the Capitol building and the Potomac River was the neighborhood, it is the neighborhood of Southwest. Mm-hmm. And Southwest at the time had been a vibrant, largely African-American, but also white and particularly Jewish neighborhood, and but was a neighborhood that had a lot of older housing, what were called alley dwellings, where there was not kind of modern plumbing. There was so it was seen as a kind of an easy early target for this policy of urban renewal, and particularly given that politicians from around the country were sitting in their offices in the Capitol, looking out their windows mm-hmm. to see this neighborhood. It was one of the first such large-scale projects. And, you know, urban renewal took many shapes, you know, but the form that it took in Southwest D.C. and then was replicated in other parts of the country was really large-scale clearance and demolition mm-hmm. of entire portions of, mm-hmm. of neighborhoods. And so Southwest was targeted early on for urban renewal and resulted in the displacement of more than 23,000 residents, more than 1,500 businesses. And, you know, at the time, there was not a great deal, at least in the late 50s, early 60s, a lot of pushback against that because mm-hmm. the neighborhood was seen and perceived by many, particularly from outside the neighborhood, as blighted, quote-unquote mm-hmm. blighted, in need of modernizing and redevelopment. But when people began to see the kind of destruction that was meted out on the neighborhood and the communities that were there, you saw neighborhoods across the city of Washington responding to that kind of urban renewal, just as you saw communities across the country responding to it. And so a lot of the organizing and activism in Washington in the 1960s and 70s, among other issues, among other many other important issues, really was looking to tackle urban renewal and trying mm-hmm. to reshape it and make it serve communities that were living in different neighborhoods.
So as you enter the exhibit, Southwest is the first community in Washington, D.C. that you'll learn about. So in Southwest, you in the 60s, it went through urban renewal again in the late.
So urban renewal really took off in the 1960s, although it began in the 1950s. You began to see some of the demolition at the very end of the 1950s in 1958, 59, and throughout the 1960s and even through the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. And so what you see in that part of the exhibition are artifacts from everyday life in Southwest, and particularly some of the institutions that were affected. Important neighborhood institutions were churches and synagogues. Mm-hmm. And so we have artifacts from Mount Moriah Baptist Church, Zion Baptist Church, mm-hmm. And Talmud Torah Synagogue, which mm-hmm. all were congregations in Southwest that were neighborhood congregations. People lived within blocks mm-hmm. of their congregations and of their churches and synagogues and could walk there. Mm-hmm. And those congregations were forced to sell their property to the Redevelopment Land Agency, which was the city agency tasked with overseeing urban renewal. And so the congregations, not only the physical churches and synagogues, had to move to other parts of the cities, but mm-hmm. also the entire communities that attended services at those congregations were displaced and had to relocate. Mm-hmm. And so for us, the artifacts speak to the extent to which urban renewal really impacted and transformed the communities in Southwest. And so we have, for instance, a collection plate from Mount Moriah Baptist Church. We have a brochure from the 65th anniversary of the church, which mm-hmm. was celebrated just a couple of years before mm-hmm. they were forced to sell the church. Mm-hmm. We have the cornerstone from the old Zion Baptist Church in Southwest, which now is on Blagden Avenue Northwest off of 16th Street. So you had just all of these really vibrant communities, religious communities around the churches and synagogues that were displaced. But we also tell the story of institutions like the Southwest Community House, which mm-hmm. played an important role in sustaining the community during and after urban renewal. The Southwest Community House was established in 1902 to provide social services specifically to African-American residents in Southwest, because the other settlement houses, social service agencies, were segregated for whites only. But during and after urban renewal, Southwest Community House was a kind of place where people could go in need of anything from clothes to food to any kind of social service. Mm-hmm. And Southwest Community House continued that role until it closed in the early 2000s. And they would do things like organize an annual family Southwest Family Day picnic, mm-hmm. that would bring people out from all over Southwest.
Which they still have today.
So, you know, we're not only looking at the kind of the ways the neighborhood was transformed, but also trying to honor the institutions and people that helped sustain community in the midst of and in the aftermath of all of that transformation. I would say also in Southwest and in each neighborhood, we have in the exhibition video interviews,
okay.
With people, longtime residents, talking about the changes that they've witnessed and the various kinds of organizing activism they've been involved with. And so in Southwest, we have Miss Roberta Patrick, who was born and raised in Southwest, witnessed urban renewal as it was happening, and then went on to become a longtime staff member of the Southwest Community House,
mm-hmm.
and really became an unsung neighborhood hero, because she was seen as somebody that was always there for residents whenever they were in need. And then we also have Neil Pierce, who moved to Southwest in 1961, just as the neighborhood was being transformed by urban renewal. And he went on to co-found, within a couple years of his moving there, an organization called the Southwest Neighborhood Assembly, which is still in existence today, and is known at, for short as SWANA.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually one of the first intentionally racially integrated neighborhood associations in the city. Prior to that time in Southwest, as was the case in neighborhoods across the city, you had citizens associations, which were all white, and civic associations, which were all black. And so as Southwest was being transformed by urban renewal, residents came together and saw the need to create a racially integrated neighborhood association that would try to unify the neighborhood in the midst of all of that change.
Okay. Just a quick plug to let everyone know you're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio. On today's show, we are talking with Dr. Samir Magelli, Chief Curator at the Anacostia Museum, and we're discussing the new exhibit, A Right to the City. And so there are six neighborhoods in this exhibit, Southwest. And then once you go from, it kind of flows through different neighborhoods. So you go from Southwest and then you're moving into Anacostia. And so can you share with us the significance of the integration of Sousa Middle School?
Yeah, so part of the reason we moved from Southwest to Anacostia is that so many of the residents that were displaced from Southwest during urban renewal ended up east of the river and in Anacostia in particular. But the story we're telling in Anacostia section of the exhibition is really about a community that was transformed by what we term in the exhibition segregation, desegregation, and resegregation, because Anacostia historically was really actually two communities, one white, one black, living side by side.
The black community being Hillsdale, the white community being Anacostia.
That's right. So the historic African-American community being Hillsdale, also mm-hmm. known as historic Berry Farm, and the white community originally being called Uniontown, and then eventually Anacostia.
Right.
And so, you know, Anacostia was transformed in particular by school desegregation. Everyone knows the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown v. Board of Ed, that desegregated the nation's schools, but that only applied to states, not the federal city. And mm-hmm. so the companion case to Brown v. Board of Ed that did desegregate D.C. public schools was Bowling v. Sharp in May of 1954. And that case grew out of an effort to integrate what in 1950 was a newly built junior high school called Sousa Junior High, John Philip Sousa Junior High, which was whites only. There were residents of east of the river residents, along with others from around the city, that had been working to integrate, actually pushing for equal schools first, not necessarily even integrated schools, but eventually integrated schools. And I think residents found it particularly egregious that a newly built school, brand new, was opening and was going to be whites only. And an organization called the Consolidated Parent Group, which was the main organization in D.C. pushing for integration, tried to enroll black students at Sousa Junior High and were denied admission. And a legal case grew out of that that ended up going to the Supreme Court. And along with Broward v. Board of Ed, was handed down, and the decision was handed down in May of 1954. And so between May of 1954 and September of 1954, Washington, D.C.'s public schools were integrated, both the faculties and the student bodies. And what you saw in Anacostia, which was not unlike in other neighborhoods across the city, was nearly immediately white flight from the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so in a matter of 5-10 years, mm-hmm. In Anacostia, where you once had these two communities, one white, one black, living side by side in segregated worlds, was white flight to other parts of the city and to the suburbs. And so Anacostia went from there's really these two communities side by side to a decreasing white population and a growing black population.
And I think that the photo in the exhibit of the students at Sousa really, you know, shows you how quickly the population,
absolutely. So we have a series of photographs of class pictures mm-hmm. from Sousa Junior High School, class of 1953, which was all white, class of 1955, which was the first integrated class with three black students. And mm-hmm. then
one of them being
Frederick Drew Gregory, who later went on to be the first African-American to command a space mission for NASA.
And his father actually has a library. Francis Gregory Library is named after him.
That's right. So Frederick Drew Gregory's father, Francis Gregory, was at one time assistant superintendent for what was called the colored schools, which mm-hmm. was the black schools in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's now a D.C. Public Library branch named after him. And then the final class picture is the class of 1960. And you can see already that from 1955 to 1960, the class has gone from approximately, 95% white to about maybe 15% white. And mm-hmm. so that change in the school demographics reflects the changes in the neighborhood. And so that's why we kind of title that part of the exhibition Segregation, Desegregation, and Resegregation, because really what it was a process of resegregation over the course of the 1950s and 60s when Anacostia went from being these two communities, one white, one black, to largely one community, mm-hmm. Black community. And so the Anacostia section really uncovers some of those stories, tells some of those stories about the neighborhood and the changes that it underwent in the 1950s and 60s.
So talk just briefly about, I think her name is Patty Cogan.
So Sheila Cogan.
Sheila Cogan. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes. So Sheila Cogan is one of the people whose interviews appears in the Anacostia section. And she grew up on Southern Avenue near the border with Prince George's County and grew up as part of what was a small Jewish community in Southeast D.C., in the 1940s and 50s. And she describes, from her personal experience, mm-hmm. First of all, being a student at Sousa Junior High in the fall of 1954 when it was integrated for the first time. So she describes that experience, but she also describes what she witnessed in her neighborhood, what was, as she describes it, termed blockbusting, mm-hmm. Where real estate agents would bring in black home buyers in mm-hmm. all-white neighborhoods to try to capitalize on fears about declining home prices. And so she describes her neighborhood as being transformed within a matter of a few years, mm-hmm. where as soon as the first black family moved into the neighborhood, that white residents began selling their homes at a rapid pace. And so, just hearing her describe mm-hmm. it from her experience is powerful, because yes. that's a process that we rarely hear about and rarely talk about, particularly from the perspective of those who fled the mm-hmm. neighborhood. And so for her to share that was just a really powerful thing.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, there are six neighborhoods. There's Southwest, Anacostia. You have Shaw. You have Brooklyn. You have Adams Morgan. You have Chinatown. So we're not going to be able to, you know, go through all of them. But I want to mention, let's go next to Shaw.
Yeah, so Shaw, you know, is an important neighborhood in this story because the neighborhood really began to respond to what was happening in Southwest with urban renewal by creating an organization founded by Reverend Walter Fauntroy, who was then, for a few years in the early 1960s, he had served as a pastor of New Bethel Baptist Church, which was his home church, having been born and raised in Shaw. And he created an organization called the Model Inner City Community Organization, or MICO for short, that called out Southwest as being a powerful example of what urban renewal looked like, you know, the large-scale demolition and clearance of an entire neighborhood. And, you know, his plan for Shaw was to really rally residents and small business owners to help shape the urban renewal plan for this neighborhood that actually he helped, in a sense, name Shaw. Prior to the mid-1960s, the neighborhood didn't necessarily have a name. You had 7th Street Corridor, mm-hmm. you had the U Street Corridor. Mm-hmm. You did have LaDroit Park just to the north, which was a historic neighborhood, but Shaw did not really have a name. And there was Shaw Junior High School right there at the corner of 7th and Rhode Island, which for a long time was a well-respected school in the so-called colored school division of the D.C. Mm-hmm. Public Schools. And by the late 1950s, early 1960s, the school was in such disrepair and was overcrowded that neighborhood residents started referring to it as Shameful Shaw. And so the neighborhood redevelopment plan that the Model Inner City Community Organization developed with residents was based around Robert Gould Shaw Junior High School, since they wanted that to be the center of the redevelopment plan, you know, mm-hmm. to have a new school built, mm-hmm. And that the neighborhood redevelopment would center around that. And so the plan that they developed was the Shaw School Urban Renewal Area Plan, and that was in 1966, 67, and 68. And it was really only in the aftermath of that that people began to refer to the neighborhood as Shaw. Through that organization, they were able to really develop a urban renewal plan would help develop affordable housing in the neighborhood, provide assistance for home repairs, and really try to get the community involved in the process of urban renewal. And they did so largely successfully, although only for a few years. And so much of the affordable housing that you see along 7th Street in Shaw was housing that had been at least planned for by that organization in the 1960s.
And there's two videos of rare footage shown of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. visiting Shaw. And this was in 1967. 13 months later, he was assassinated. But he came there, I guess, as Walter Fauntroy. Dr. Fauntroy invited him to come and to kind of speak and encourage the residents of the community.
Yeah, so Reverend Fauntroy was the D.C. representative for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the organization that Dr. King headed. And Reverend Fauntroy, invited Dr. King to come speak and lead a parade through Shaw mm-hmm. in support of the Model Inner City Community Organization and their redevelopment plan. And so Dr. King led a parade through the neighborhood from Dunbar High School to Cardozo High School. Which was, you know, just this celebration by the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There was school bands, there was beauty queens, mm-hmm. there was all kinds of local organizations that participated. It was the largest march, local march in the city since the August 1963 March on Washington. And Dr. King ended the parade by giving a speech at Cardozo High School, which is a little known speech, but was a really important speech, particularly for the city, because what Dr. King was saying was really encouraging residents and small business owners to participate in the process of mm-hmm. redevelopment to help shape the plans for the neighborhood. And he mm-hmm. called it, at the time, one of the most important efforts, such efforts happening in the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was his support of the organization and its efforts that was able to get it some important federal funding to carry out its plans. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we were able to find what I think is essentially rarely seen footage of Dr. King leading the parade through Shaw and then giving a speech at Cardozo High School.
Wow. So we're kind of running low on time, but we cannot talk about Adams Morgan. We are sitting in Adams Morgan right now in this community. Talk about that. Talk about the changes that went on in this community.
So like so many other neighborhoods, the community now known as Adams Morgan underwent a lot of change in the mid-20th century around the time of school desegregation. When the Bowling v. Sharp case was handed down in May of 54, parents at two local elementary schools in really what was a cluster of historic subdivisions of Lanier Heights, Calorama, Midway, students, parents, and teachers at John Quincy Adams Elementary, which had been the historically segregated all-white school, and Thomas P. Morgan Elementary, which was the all-black school, came together and created an organization called the Adams Morgan Better Neighborhood Conference. Mm-hmm. And they were working on neighborhood issues, but chiefly wanted to help facilitate genuine integration of the schools, which they quickly saw was not going to be an easy task. And that was the first time that the names Adams and Morgan had been combined. Mm-hmm. There was a series of organizations that grew out of their efforts in the late 1950s, one called the Adams Morgan Community Council, mm-hmm. which actually was helping to try to shape mm-hmm. urban renewal that was going to come to Adams Morgan in subsequent years. And Adams Morgan, growing out of that organizing in the 1950s, ended up developing a really rich tradition mm-hmm. of activism that ended up shaping the rest of the city's politics in many ways. And so in the Adams Morgan section of the exhibition, we explore some of the history, not only of the neighborhood, but the organizations that were really important. And so some of those included one called the Ontario Lakers Youth Organization. Mm-hmm. Just a few blocks from where we're sitting here in Adams Morgan is a park now known as Walter Pierce Park. And Walter Pierce and his family moved to Adams Morgan in the summer of 1964.
From Southeast,
from Capitol right. Hill, actually. And they moved on to Ontario Place, right across the street, essentially, from where is now Walter Pierce Park. And at that time, that park was an unused lot. Mm-hmm. And since there were very few recreation opportunities in the neighborhood, and so many kids, particularly on that street, Walter Pierce and his brother Ronald Pierce actually began to occupy that vacant lot and turned it into a park mm-hmm. where they organized not only a community garden, and again, this was in the 1960s, not only a community garden, but a baseball team, football team, mm-hmm. Basketball team. And so they created, as teenagers, Walter Pierce and Ronald Pierce created the Ontario Lakers.
Which they named after the LA Lakers.
They named after the LA Lakers and mm-hmm. then Ontario being the street that mm-hmm. they lived on.
Right.
And they just did incredible work as teenagers. And Walter Pierce spent the rest of his life, working with young people in the neighborhood. He and his brother later created in the early 1970s a basketball tournament called the Ghetto Invitational Basketball Tournament, which brought top players from across the city, including some who went on to play in the NBA. And so they were able to gain control of this vacant lot. And eventually, after almost 15 years of lobbying the city to purchase the land, were successful in getting congressional appropriation to purchase the land and turn it into an official public park. And it was called Community Park West for many years. Walter Pierce passed in 1991, relatively young, and in 1995 the park was renamed in his honor. And so that's one story that kind of reveals just the incredible work that was being done in the neighborhood. But there was also
the new thing. Talk about
something
that.
Called the new thing, Art and Architecture Center, right. which was founded by a man named Topper Carew, who at the time had actually come down from Boston to attend Howard University, joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had done voter registration in rural Mississippi, and in his senior year of the architecture program at Howard, left the program just out of frustration with what he saw as being its apolitical kind of nature, and set up shop in Adams Morgan in 1966 as a so-called community architect who would help residents advocate in planning and architecture projects. And he ended up turning his office into this just incredible arts center for young people and kind of urban planning advocacy organization called the New Thing Art and Architecture Center that became a home to just incredible teachers of art, so photographers, filmmakers,
African drumming,
West African drumming and dancing,
right?
You know, people that have become institutions not only in this city but across the country taught there. So Melvin Deal and the African Heritage Dancers and Drummers began some of their early work there. Eric Gravatt, who is a jazz percussionist, went on to play with Herbie Hancock and the Weather Report, was a teacher at the New Thing. Topper Crew himself, after leaving the New Thing in the mid-70s, went on to become a Hollywood filmmaker and made the movie D.C. Cab, which is a kind of a cult classic movie about D.C. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, he went on to
produce
The Martin Show with Martin Lawrence.
Right.
So the New Thing, though, was really important because at a time in the city where there were very few institutions that were black run, he set up this organization that empowered hundreds of young people, not just in Adams Morgan, but across the city. And, you know, it went on to have a huge impact on the art scene, not just in the city, but even nationally. So that's another organization that's featured. And I would say the other one that's really important was an organization called the Adams Morgan Organization, which formed in 1972 and grew out of the work of the New Thing and the Ontario Lakers to try to create, and actually did create, a neighborhood government. This was at a time when the city of Washington had no elected city council, no elected mayor. There was just the appointed mayor, Walter Washington. And so the neighborhood saw a need to actually create a local government, and so they created a literal neighborhood government in which residents elected representatives that would advocate for the issues that were important to the neighborhood. And the work that the Adams Morgan organization did ended up serving as a model for what became known as the Advisory Neighborhood Commissions when D.C. got Home Rule in 1974. And along with that, this idea of what were going to be called the Advisory Neighborhood Councils originally, but then eventually the Advisory Neighborhood Commissions was modeled after the kind of local government that Adams Morgan organization set up. And they did incredible work around all kinds of things. I mean, they helped lobby to get the Walter Pierce Park turned into an official public park. They advocated for important tenants' rights legislation in the city, which continue to serve as important tenants' protections. And so they were, in many ways, just a trailblazing organizing force in the city in a lot of different realms. And so Adams Morgan has this rich history, which I think
is... And please, I can't let you leave without talking about Bishop Marie Reed.
Absolutely.
And her work in this community.
Yeah, so, you know, many people in Washington, and even especially in Adams Morgan, are familiar with Marie Reed Elementary School. But the story of that school is really important and kind of connects to some of the history that I was mentioning earlier. Bishop Reed was a local bishop in Washington who had her own church, but also oversaw a number of churches in the area. And she was just this charismatic, compelling neighborhood figure who really was an advocate for residents and young people. And in the mid-1960s, when the efforts of the Adams Morgan Better Neighborhood Conference to integrate the neighborhood schools really was seen to be unsuccessful, she helped lead an effort to gain community control of what was then called Morgan Elementary School. And her efforts, along with others in the neighborhood, helped the Morgan School become one of the first community-controlled schools in the nation. And this was an effort of, you know, that took place in a lot of cities, of neighborhoods to wrest control of their local school from the Board of Education. And she was able to do that along with others on the what was actually a locally elected school board for the Morgan School. And they were able to gain control of budget, teacher hiring, curriculum at the school, and changed its official name to the Morgan Community School. Unfortunately, she passed just a couple of years after it became the Morgan Community School, and it was decided you know, that the school itself, when it was going to be newly built and completed in 1977 or thereabouts, to be renamed in her honor. And so that school carries her name today, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, really tries to carry on her legacy.
Wow. Samir, you're like a walking encyclopedia. I can talk to you all day. I can listen to these stories all day. But unfortunately, we are running out of time. But I like to do this thing where I ask my guests five questions just off the top of your head. First thing that comes to mind, okay?
All right.
It's fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who is your favorite hip-hop artist?
Honestly, that's too difficult. I have to
off the top of your head, who comes to mind? Okay, West Coast or East Coast, hip hop?
East Coast. I mean, I'm from the East Coast, so there's no question there.
Which historical figure would you most like to interview, dead or alive?
Wow,
you should say Marcus Garvey, but
no, I mean there's just so many. I'm not good at these questions because, you know. It's hard to choose just one.
Okay. What are you passionate? What are you most passionate about?
I mean, as a historian, I'm going to have to say history, because that's what I love to do.
And how would you like to be remembered?
Honestly, you know, as someone who made some small contribution to the work of bettering the world that we live in.
Great answer. And so what are you working on next? Any upcoming projects for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would just say, first of all, that we look forward to welcoming folks to the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum for this exhibition.
And to also plug, this is the 50th anniversary of the museum. So there's a accompanying exhibit there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a small accompanying exhibit called Your Community, Your Story, celebrating 5 decades of the Anacostia Community Museum, that's up right alongside of Right to the City. And so I would just encourage listeners to come and visit us.
Mm-hmm.
It will be up for the next 2 years, and we'll have a lot of exciting, interesting programming, public programs alongside the exhibition, not just at the museum, but throughout the city.
Mm-hmm.
We are working with our friends at the DC Public Library to develop satellite exhibits that mm-hmm. will appear in several of the branch libraries. And so I encourage folks to keep an eye out for those.
And to shout out my colleagues in Special Collections, because several of the photos that accompany this exhibit came from our
Special
Collections.
Absolutely, more than several. I would say a lot.
Okay.
And so, yeah, shout out to Special Collections, Washingtoniana, D.C. Public Library.
Carrie, Derek,
Michelle
Casto.
There's so many folks that are doing important work at the D.C. Public Library. And, you know, I have to say that that's been one of the really fun parts of the job, of my job, just spending time in the rich collections of the D.C. Public Library, which house so much of this city's history and I think deserve to be better known.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also encourage folks to check out, you know, for people who really want to dig into D.C. history, to check out the Special Collections.
Yes. Well, thank you, Samir, for joining me today. This has been an episode of DCPL's All Things Local on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Please visit dclibrary.org to learn more about the library's services and programs. Talk to us online at DCPL on Twitter and at DC Public Library on Instagram. Listen and download this show wherever you listen to your podcasts by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you for listening.